today, as we dig deeper into God's providence in our bittersweet series, we're going to look at what it means to develop a biblical and a hopeful perspective on suffering. Many people who develop interest in Jesus, some sort of interest in Jesus, they never fully commit to him. They never execute what it means to have faith and to embrace the gospel. And I believe that one of those reasons why is that they do not have a biblical and hopeful perspective on suffering. So when stuff happens, they don't know how to respond to it and how to think about God in that particular situation of suffering. If God is a God of love, they think, man, wouldn't he just take suffering away? Like, what's going on with that? But this is not what we're learning through this family of Elimelech, right? I mean, there's tragedy after tragedy in this family. For Naomi, she has accurately noted that God's hand is involved in everything that's going on with her. In Old Testament history, God brought famine to reveal disobedience among his people. There's this passage in Deuteronomy 11. And it's verses 13 to 17, and it kind of strikes the chord in what I'm saying right now. The text says that it shall come about, if you listen obediently to my commandments, which I'm commanding you today, to love the Lord your God, to serve him with all your heart and all your soul, that what? He will give the rain for your land in its season, the early, the late rain, that you may gather in your grain and your new wine and oil. He will give grass in your fields for your cattle. You will eat and be satisfied. But here's the contrast. Beware that your hearts are not deceived, that you do not turn away and serve other gods and worship them. Or the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you. He'll shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the ground will not yield its fruit, and you will perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. Now this verse is clear. For the Israelites, at this point in time, God's covenant people, obedience had a real, tangible result, which was rain. And the converse is true. Disobedience had a real, tangible result for the Israelites, which was famine. So both obedience and disobedience was a heart issue for the Israelites during this time. Whether an Israelite loved and served the Lord with all their heart and with all of their soul. So right after the famine in this family's life, Elimelech takes his family, leaves Bethlehem, and transplants them to Moab. God made a covenant with all the Israelites, that because they are a son and daughter of Abraham, that he will always provide for them. So the famine revealed Elimelech's disobedience. We looked at that in Ruth chapter 1. He trusted in himself and loved his own life. He loved his own family's life above God. And today's text is going to help us to develop this biblical and this hopeful perspective on suffering. Within suffering, we have to know who's involved and what's going on with it, how it came about. Listen to the words of Job. Job's talking about his experience, his suffering with his buddies, and here's what he says about it. And this is intense. Job says in verse 5, in chapter 5, verse 17 to 18, he says, "Behold, how happy is the man whom God reproves." Okay? "So do not despise the discipline of the Almighty, for he inflicts pain and he gives relief. He wounds and his hands also heal." This is Job's view of suffering, and he is currently going through suffering. This is a sweet and necessary view of suffering. And this is going to become Naomi's view in our passage today. And the final analysis, it has to become our view of suffering. In Job's case, disobedience wasn't the cause of his suffering. He's not like Elimelech. He obeyed the Lord, and bad stuff still happened in his life. He lost his kids. He lost his possessions. And it was all because Satan had a desire to hurt Job. That was the cause of his suffering. Job says that the man who God reproves is a happy man. This doesn't make sense. Job says that the man that God reproves should not despise this discipline that he's going through. So we learn an occasion for some suffering. Suffering is meant to discipline us, to get us into the shape that God wants for our lives. Therefore, God is the one who inflicts the pain, and he's the one who gives the relief. He's the one that wounds, but he's also the one that heals. The Apostle Peter, in his epistle, he gives another occasion for suffering. For Peter, the ultimate reason why, if you just strip it down and say, what is the big reason? Why do Christians suffer? It's because our Lord is a sufferer and we are in Christ. And if he had a reception on this earth that was betrayal, being spit upon, being beaten, and we are in him, then we will experience some of those same things. And here's the thing. You have to know this if you want to follow Christ. You have to know that the life of the Christian is going to entail at some point some suffering. The Christian life is filled with joy and sorrow. We are a paradoxical people. Sometimes we experience joy and sorrow within the same event, within the same day. And the book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus, when he suffered, he was able to survive the suffering and get to the end of it because he set the joy of what was going to happen after the suffering. He knew that after he endured the pain on the cross, that all these things would happen, that people would come to him, people would be restored to God the Father. And this is what we're after in Ruth 2 this morning as we wrap up this chapter. So what we're going to do today, we're just going to pick up these pieces, all these different pieces, these breadcrumbs, and put them together so we can gather this biblical and hopeful view of suffering. So let's get to the proposition. The proposition, and this is a bold truth, is that hope is restored to those who suffer in God's perfect timing. This is one of God's intended messages of Ruth. Suffering is normal. And there's nothing else that you get out of this series is to walk in to know that suffering is a normal Christian experience. We live in a fallen world, and we build relationships with people who are fallen. We have to acknowledge this. We cannot go into this life with these rosy-colored glasses that everything is going to be great. There are many potential reasons for suffering, but ultimately the Christian knows this about suffering. It's two things that we know, that Christ's followers suffer because Christ suffered, and that ultimately God is in control of whatever suffering that I am going through. And here's the good news. God will restore hope to the Christ follower. I want you to look at some other words of Job. If Job can say this during a time of suffering, so can you. It's Job 13, 15, and it says, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Simple statement, a great verse to memorize. This is one of my favorite verses in Job. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. I memorized this verse when I was 16 years old and dealing with my own adversities of a 16-year-old Joe growing up. Job hoped in God, even though he knew ultimately it was God's hand that was doing this to him. It's paradoxical that Job would do this, but it's biblical. And Naomi is going to catch this glimmer of hope at the end of chapter 2 this morning. And this is what we're after together, to be so in love with God, to trust so much in him, that even though he may slay us, we're going to hope in him. We're going to trust in him. This is God's aim within your suffering this morning, church, to trust and to hope in him no matter what suffering we are currently experiencing. The key phrase in the proposition this morning is that last phrase. It says, in God's perfect timing. For Naomi, she has been waiting 10 to 20 years to feel something from God. It's been death and tragedy and death and tragedy. Naomi, at this point, she thinks that her hope has shriveled up and it has died. There's no emotion left between her and God. All that is left in her life is bitterness. And Ruth's suffering, it's been going on for at least 10 years. She has dealt with childlessness for 10 years and the death of her husband for about a year. Now, your suffering, it could be similar to what these ladies are experiencing. It could be different. You may have been suffering for months, you may have been suffering for years, and you could be suffering for decades, just like Naomi is. And my prayer for you today, I've been praying this all week for you, is that you would trust in the scriptures, that you would hold on to the promise of hope that is in this book, and God will show up. So let's read our text this morning. We're going to pick up in chapter 2 again, and we're going to be in verse 14, and we're going to read it through to the end, and then we'll be done with Ruth 2. Here's what it says. It says, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar. So she sat beside the reapers and he served her roasted grain. And she ate and was satisfied and had some left. When she rose to glean, Boaz commanded his servants, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not insult her. Also, you shall purposely pull out for her some grain from the bundles, and leave it, that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. Her mother-in-law then said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz." Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Again, Naomi said to her, "The man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives." Then Ruth the Moabitess said, "Furthermore, he said to me, 'You should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest.'" Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with this maid so that others do not fall upon you in another field." So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So at the end of chapter 2, we see a biblical, a hopeful perspective of suffering beginning to form in the heart of Naomi. God is using Boaz to play this instrumental role of restoring hope to these two women. So let's go back to the fields with Ruth and Boaz. Let's peel these words piece by piece together, and let's see what God has to say. Here's point one. Point one is that Boaz's provision brought satisfaction to Ruth. Last week, we saw Boaz's benevolence. If you missed it last week, go on our website, take a listen to it. You've got to catch this. You got to catch what's going on with Boaz to kind of understand what's going on here. As men, last week, we were challenged to reconstruct our view of relating to the significant women in our lives after the fashion of Boaz. The big point for the men was, be Boaz. Learn from him. Go do it with your women. That was the point of the message last week. Boaz will take care of Ruth, not because she's incapable, not because she isn't smart enough, she isn't good enough, but because God wants to display his providence through the worthy men in her life. And in verse 14, Boaz continues to provide. Let's look at it together. Verse 14 says, "At mealtime, Boaz said to her, 'Come here, that you may eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar.' So she sat beside the reapers, and he served her roasted grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some left." Boaz gives Ruth the strong and the sweet invitation. He says, come to me. He invites her to come, to eat, to be satisfied. He commands her. He's telling her what to do here. But he's also tender as he goes about it. A key recipe as a man relates to women, being strong and being tender. This is relationships at its best. So Ruth sits down for the meal, and Boaz serves her. He gives her the roasted grain. You have to remember, she is not an Israelite. She's a foreigner. She's from Moab. She's different. She looks different. She speaks different. And here is this man, this prominent man, with his workers around, and he is serving her. It's a mind-blowing scene. So Boaz gives her food, and she eats until she's satisfied. And Ruth's satisfaction is just a culmination of all that's happening in this one day, this very first day that she goes to work to provide for her and her mom. Boy, it is abundant. Ruth is satisfied, and she even has leftovers. So after mealtime, Ruth is energized to get back to work. But before she does, Boaz wants to know, he wants Ruth to know that he is serious about this commitment that he's making to her. And he says in verses 15 and 16, says that when she rose to glean, that Boaz commanded his servants, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not insult her. You shall purposely pull out some of the grain from the bundles and leave it so she can glean, and do not rebuke her." Boaz is telling his servants that they are his representative while she is working in the fields. They have to let her glean. They got to pull some stuff out for her, make it even a little bit easier for her. They're told not to insult her, not to rebuke her. Now, you can remember, think about it. These are reapers, workers for this man. And here's this pagan, different lady coming. They got to do stuff for her? Can you imagine some of the reapers through? Oh, I can't believe Ruth. We got to do this for her. That's why he says, don't insult her. Don't rebuke her. So Boaz is clear on this point. Do you remember last week when Boaz is talking to Ruth? And he says that one of the things is that Ruth has come under the wings of God. And we talked about the protection that's underneath the wings of God. And here is what Boaz is saying. Now that you're here, and now that I see you for the first time, I want you to come under my wings. I want to protect you. I want to provide for you. This is beautiful, church, the way this man and this woman is relating with each other. So in verse 17, Ruth, she finishes her first day of work in Bethlehem. And verse 17 says that she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And an ephah is basically a bushel. Now, there's some research, and they said it's about 8 gallons. I guess we can even weigh it that way. So, and even more than that, she has leftovers from lunch, and she's ready to go home to Naomi. And in verse 18, we see Ruth return. In verse 18, it says she took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. So Ruth heads back from the fields into Bethlehem, and Naomi sees Ruth. More importantly, Naomi sees what Ruth is bringing home after one day of work. Now, can you imagine how Ruth feels right now? Ruth has promised Naomi, I'm never going to leave you. I'll always be there. Where you go, I'm going to go. Where you stay, I'm going to stay. I'll be with you. This is my commitment to you. She sets out that day. She wants to find a man that can find favor, that will look at her, and she finds it. Boaz is compelled to take care of Ruth, to provide for her because of Ruth's love and commitment for Naomi. And Ruth may not know it yet, but it was God's guiding hand that led her to glean in Boaz's field. She has security under the wings of Boaz. She has security under the wings of God. And God has abundantly provided for both Ruth and Naomi. So let's get to Naomi, because this is the important part. Let's see how Naomi reacts to Ruth's first day at work. And that goes into point two. Point two is that Ruth's experience awakened Naomi's slumbering hope. 10 to 20 years of suffering almost killed Naomi's hope. She feels so bitter, but now things are about to change. Like we sang a moment ago, that hope is stirring. We're going to stir it up right now. But before we look at these remaining verses, let's just summarize what Naomi's suffering has been. Her family experienced famine. Now, can you imagine, as a mama, watching your kids starve? She had a disobedient husband who decided to take her family away from Bethlehem to the land of Moab, a strange place, a different place, a foreign land, even though God promised them that land. He leaves. Elimelech dies shortly after this. Her sons marry pagan women. Her sons are incapable of having children. 10 years of marriage for these two boys, and they have no children. Then she has to watch as her sons die. She said she had no hope. She believes that God's hand is against her. She even said that God is a witness against her in life. She thinks that God has just given her bitterness for life. That's all that life is. She said, don't call me Mara. Life is just Mara, Mara, bitterness. But then Ruth comes home with a bushel of barley and some leftovers from lunch, and everything changes for Naomi. So she speaks in verse 19. And in verse 19, it says, her mother-in-law then said to her, where'd you glean today? Where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed. Now, mama has questions, right? Ruth's been gone the whole day. She comes home from work. She wants the scoop. So she sees the surplus that Ruth has brought home after just one day of work. And she is already speaking blessing upon whoever it was that helped Ruth that day. Now, does that sound like a woman who believes that all life is bitter? It's just bitter, bitter, bitter all the time. No, it's because hope is awakening. Hope is waking up from its slumber. After 10 to 20 years of tragedy after tragedy, hope is almost choked out of Naomi's life. But since Naomi truly knew and loved the Lord, hope wasn't dead. It was just sleeping. It was just dormant. It was just waiting for something for God to stir. And this is the encouragement that many of us need this morning. Hope isn't dead, church. Whatever you are experiencing right now, hope is not dead. It's just dormant. It's waiting for God just to stir the pot yet again. Many of you have not felt joy or you have not felt hope in the Lord for a while. It's not dead. It's just dormant. Learn from Naomi's example. Keep living. Keep trying. Keep surviving. Put yourself around people like Ruth. God will use her to awaken hope in you. Naomi knew that God's hand was in her adversity. She thought it was God's involvement, why things were against her, that even God himself was against her. But Naomi also knew that God was involved in the abundance. So Ruth speaks. Ruth recounts her first day at work, and she tells of her encounter with the man in whom she found favor. And we see it in the next phrase in verse 19. It says, "So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, 'The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz.'" So Ruth names the man who took notice of her. It's Boaz. And look at Naomi's reaction to the name of Boaz. You got to look at it. It says in the next phrase, "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead." Naomi's praising God here. Naomi's asking, "God, bless Boaz." Why? Because through Boaz, through his provision, through his protection, God is showing kindness to her and to her family that has already died. A man in the family of Elimelech is taking care of his widows. Now, the Hebrew word that's used for kindness here is chesed. I think I brought it up a couple weeks ago in Ruth chapter 1. It's one of the most used words in the Tanakh, the Old Testament scriptures, to describe God's love. What agape is to the New Testament, chesed is to the Old Testament. Most of the time when we talk about God's love, it's going to be chesed. This is loving kindness. This is loyal love that never fails, like we sang about a while ago in the Lord our God. This is what Boaz is showing to Naomi and Ruth. Naomi now knows that God is showing chesed to her again. She can feel it. Now, can you imagine what that feels like? She hasn't felt God in decades. She hasn't heard God speak. She hasn't felt the comfort of God. She has felt nothing, absolutely nothing. And then she feels hope again. This is why, as men, our commitment to the worthy women in our lives, we have to be committed to move and to act and to show compassion to them, because God is going to use us to restore hope in them. I can't wait to get to Mother's Day next Sunday and get to Ruth chapter 3. It's going to be good. We hope that through our example, others will see chesed through us, the loving kindness of the Lord through our actions as men. In Boaz, God is showing loving kindness to Ruth, to Naomi, and the whole family of Elimelech. Can you see Naomi's hope waking up? Can you see it in the text this morning, church? She felt that God's hand was against her. God's hand was involved, but it was to bring Naomi back to the point of where he wanted her to be. Now she's beginning to see and to feel loving kindness. And Naomi's not done yet. She keeps talking. The next phrase, it says, "Again, Naomi said to her, 'This man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives.'" Now, this statement, it is packed with meaning. Last week, we learned that Boaz was part of the family of Elimelech, Naomi's dead husband. Today, Naomi tells Ruth that not only is Boaz part of his family, he is one of the closest relatives to Elimelech. Now, the phrase "closest relatives" means that Boaz, it's so beautiful what this means in Hebrew, he is redeemer. That's what it really means. Or he is avenger. He is the family's redeemer, the family's avenger. Now, what she's referencing right now when she says this is another passage in Deuteronomy. This is Deuteronomy 25. And the text is 5 through 10, but I'm just going to read one verse. I have to give a disclaimer. This verse, it's a little bit graphic, but it's sweet. It says, "When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her." this passage, there's other passages like this in the Torah that develops this concept for the Israelites called the kinsman redeemer. When something happens in a family, family members step up and they redeem the situation. This is what Naomi is referencing here. She's beginning to dream again, church. She's beginning to hope again. Boaz is in this family. Boaz could be our redeemer. She is referencing Old Testament law here. This is a woman that knows her Bible. And we have to remember, like, what's going on? What would be the purpose of this? You have to remember, and we're studying this all throughout the Gospel Project. Think back to Genesis, back to Abraham. God makes a covenant with Abraham. Through you, through your seed, through your family, he promised a couple things, that they would be as numerous as sand on the seashore, that they would be just as numerous as the stars in the sky. God promises Abraham tons and tons and tons of descendants. And even most of all, there's another promise that through one of these people, through one of these descendants, there is going to be a man that all of the families of the earth are going to be blessed. And that's a reference to eventually a son of Abraham called Jesus. But that's the whole point of the kinsman redeemer. This line has to continue because God made a promise and God isn't going to break his promises. So the kinsman redeemer was developed. So there's a plan forming in Naomi's mind. She's hopeful. She is dreaming that something may be able to be done. Through the kinsman redeemer, Ruth may be able to find a husband. And this makes her hopeful. In verse 21, Ruth tells Naomi of Boaz's intention. In verse 21, it says, then Ruth the Moabitess said, furthermore, he said to me, you should stay close to my servants till they have finished all my harvest. Boaz wants Ruth to stick around him. He is sweetly inviting her to stay around him. And look at Naomi's response to this in verse 22. In verse 22, Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maid so that others don't fall upon you in another field. She says, this is good. Can you see the hope? She's not saying Mara anymore. This is bitter. This is bad. This is good. Naomi approves of the relationship, and she encourages Ruth to follow the leadership of Boaz. She can now begin to see how God may work to restore the family of Elimelech through Ruth and through Boaz. Once again, Ruth respects and she values the insight of her mother-in-law. And then we have our final verse. So as we conclude Ruth 2, it says, so she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So Ruth obeys. She goes to work. She stays in Boaz's field. She gleans. She beats it out. She gets her bushel. She goes home. She gets up and does it all over again, day after day after day. Time goes by. She performs that same routine throughout the barley harvest and throughout the wheat harvest. In Israelite history and Israelite calendar, this is about April to June. 3 months of getting up, doing the same thing over and over and over again, and nothing happens. Nothing happens. There's nothing about Boaz going to her, like, hey, let's get to know each other. It's nothing. 3 months of the same routine over and over. We see that Boaz invited Ruth to be with him, but nothing develops for the next 3 months. But for now, God has accomplished his purpose and his desires through Ruth to restore hope into Naomi. She's beginning to feel God again after decades. So, what does this say about us? What does this say about us developing a biblical and a hopeful perspective of suffering? So let's make some connections to our lives through the point of application. The point of application is to consider reasons to hope during our season of suffering. Let's look at Naomi's reasons to hope in this season in her life. God gave her two daughters. And even though she had two daughters and one went back to Moab, one went back to Bethlehem with her. God lifted the famine in Bethlehem. And even more than that, coincidentally enough, the news of the lifting of the famine reaches all the way to Moab without technology, without social media, instant updates. God gave Ruth to Naomi, a faithful daughter who will always be with her. Beautiful. God protected Naomi and Ruth, two women traveling alone from Moab back to Bethlehem. Nothing happens to them. Naomi returns to Bethlehem right at the start of barley harvest, when it's time to work, when it's time to gather. And then Ruth connected with the perfect man to provide and to protect them. That is eight reasons to hope in God. Eight reasons so far. And here's the point, church. We have to do the same thing. We got to do the same thing. Naomi couldn't see it before because she was just so overcome by her bitterness, so overcome by her grief. And we're the same way. Sometimes it's hard to see the good hand of God while we're experiencing the adversity. You may not realize it because of your bitterness, but God's hand is involved in what you're currently experiencing. That is what he's teaching us through Ruth 2. And in my experience with suffering, it is nearly impossible in the situation to be able to look at the situation and say, God's in this. We can't do it alone. We have to depend on the Spirit of God to show us the good hand of God through it. But I want to give you one major biblical reason to find hope if you are experiencing a season of suffering, or for when you experience it coming up, because it's going to happen if you're not going through it right now. Here's one reason. It's 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 to 7. You got to write this down, put a side note in your app or something like that, take a look at it later, think about it. Here's what it says. Peter says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." 1 Peter is a suffering epistle. The Christians that Peter wrote to were going through persecution. They were going through suffering. And I believe that as history continues, for us as Christ followers in America, we are going to need 1 Peter now more than ever. I know there's a day at some point in our history together with you and I at Heritage, we are going to have to go through 1 Peter to learn how to be Christians in a culture that is antagonistic against Christians. We're getting to that point. It's no longer culturally acceptable or convenient that Christians live in this nation. It's now an inconvenience for that. And the first thing that Peter says is that hope and joy are possible during suffering. You hear that? Hope and joy is possible during suffering. How can it be? Here's some thoughts. One reason to hope is that suffering is temporary. That's why he says, though, for a little while. For Naomi, it's been 10, 20 years. For Ruth, it's been 10 years of childlessness and a year of being a widow. And for you, it could be some sort of range. It could be a year of suffering, 10 years, 20 years, I don't know. But all suffering is temporary, especially when you think about the magnitude of eternity. So all suffering is temporary. And another reason to hope is that suffering, Peter says, is necessary. It has to happen. So as a Christ follower, we should expect suffering to come. And it says that we should expect a variety of trials, a variety of sufferings on our Godward journey with the Lord. You say, how is that a reason to hope? Like, I don't see that. That verse 7 has a so that. It's cause and effect, an if and then. This happens and then this happens. Various kinds of trials and sufferings do something in the life of the Christ follower. Peter says that it creates the proof of your faith. Hoping in God during a season of suffering is proof of faith. And here's another reason. The proof of your faith that's being refined during this time of testing and suffering, Peter says that it's more valuable than wealth. It is more valuable than gold. Now you think about that. Money can distract you a lot while you're suffering, right? It can buy a lot of distractions for you, but not according to Peter. Hoping in God through suffering is more valuable to you than the riches of the world. Do you get it? Do you get that? It is more valuable than money. Because money can't buy you hope. It can give you everything you can to medicate and sedate you in your suffering, but it can't give you hope. Why? Because suffering, it tests. Suffering reveals the stuff of your character and what's going on inside of you. So when the Christ follower hopes in God within suffering, Peter says it ends in praise and glory and honor. Naomi is currently experiencing just a glimmer of this right now. Her praise is going to grow in the following chapters. Once again, I say it every single week, I cannot wait to get to chapter 4 with you. God is telling you to expect suffering. It's going to come to each and every one of us on our Godward journey. So we got to put on the seatbelts and we got to prepare for it. But I hope that Ruth chapter 2 and 1 Peter 1 will help to shape your biblical and your hopeful view of suffering during this time. Suffering is temporary. It's meant to show character. And God will use suffering to restore hope so that you can suffer for God's glory. So today is Naomi's turning point. And if you are suffering, I pray that today could be your turning point too.